Okay, welcome to EtherCon 7. I'm your host, Richard Coates, and this is Googles and Gears, a panel to discuss steampunk role-playing games. I'm joined today by Jeff Barber of Biohazard Games, Lynn Hardy of Chaosium, and Andrew Ragland of Fassa Games. Each of you in turn will start off just introducing yourselves and maybe mention a little bit about, you know, why you're on a steampunk panel. Starting with Andrew.
Yeah, I'm the line developer for 1879, which is Fassa's steampunk role-playing game. It takes the place in our cosmology of Shadowrun. We sold off Shadowrun about 20 years ago, and that left us sort of a hole in the cosmology. So we pulled the Awakening back 140 years, put it into an alternate history for the Gilded Age, and ran with it. And so here I am.
Okay, great. Okay, Jeff, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself
Sure.
and your involvement?
My name is Jeff Barber. I run a little games company on the side called Biohazard Games. If anybody knows us for anything, it's probably Blue Planet, which is a game we published 20 years ago, mm-hmm. And are looking to do a new edition of shortly. But thing we got going now is a game called Upwind. It's currently at the printers at the moment, so it should be going out soon. It's basically my love letter to Studio Ghibli's adventure films, things like Castle in the Sky and Nausicaa Valley of the Wind. And we've been calling it Pestilopunk. And I think that's sort of how I ended up on this panel. But I came in through that door, sort of the Eastern version of I guess, what we think of as cyberpunk.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Lynn, do you want to introduce yourself and why you're here?
Right, I'm Lynn Hardy. I'm currently the assistant line editor for Call of Cthulhu at Chaosium. I've been doing this sort of nonsense for far more years than I'm prepared to admit to at the moment. And I'm here because I wrote a game called Cogs, Cakes and Swordsticks, which I would show you a copy of, but my bookshelf collapsed a few weeks ago and everything's in big piles all over the place. So it's very distinctive. It has a big teapot on the cover because what else would you put on the front of it? And I basically wrote that a good few years ago now as an introductory game for cosplayers because we were doing a big event in Lincoln called The Asylum. So cool because it was actually running the building that used to be the asylum at Lincoln. And there were so many cosplayers who wanted to get into role playing, but were a little bit intimidated by the systems that were actually currently in print at that time that I thought, well, you know, I write these game things. I should write something. And that's kind of where it went from there. And Cogs, Cakes and Swordsticks also sort of became my writing sample, you know, this is what I can do for companies, which got me the Victoriana third edition editing gig for Cubicle 7. And then Modiphius published it under license while I was their line editor for Act on Cthulhu. So that's why I'm here today. I like to dress up and drink tea and eat cake and run role-playing games at steampunk conventions.
Okay, Perfect. Great. So, I mean, I think with, you know, just because we've got, 80 minutes to talk about it, we will obviously take questions from anyone who is watching. If you type those questions in, then we'll come to those. First of all, I thought, because, you know, steampunk is what, I mean, anything that ends in punk that's a genre of role-playing games, it's not always that obvious what it is. So for those that might not be that sure or want to sort of hear our take on it, does anyone have a what is your definition, panel, about of what is steampunk?
All right, well, I'll go on and lead off here. You break it up into two parts, steam and punk. Steam generally involves some form of accelerated technology based on what could have been, what might have been. in the case of 1879, for example, we said, all right, Babbage's analytical engine got built. It became a thing. And so our game world has clockwork mainframe computers. This leads to all sorts of social and economic developments, various developments that come about. We have a sort of Decker character called the Byron. Their opposite number, the system administrator, is called a Lovelace, and thus both the White Hat and the Black Hat are named after the same woman. Had a little bit of fun with that. The punk generally involves social conflict. Class struggle, economic struggle, colonialism, what have you. For to me, anyway, and this is, you know, your mileage may vary, a punk genre requires there to be some sort of struggle going on against the system where the system itself has significant problems and people are trying to correct it to some extent from the bottom up. So in a steampunk world, then, you have a pseudo-Victorian or other historical milieu based on older technologies, so with some aspects of things that might have been but didn't happen in our world, like, you know, going with airships being much more common, or clockwork computing, or what have you. And the adventures and primary conflicts in the story being based around social and class struggle. Bit long-winded, but, you know, that's me. Sorry.
Okay, that's great. So anyone else want to add to that or challenge that or just, you know, have anything else they want to say?
Jeff, do you want to go or can I sort of jump in?
Go ahead. No, please jump in.
Well, I kind of came to it through Victorian live role-playing. So there was always very much that, certainly from the British perspective, there's a large element of steampunk is dressing up, going and being excellent to each other, drinking gin, eating cake, drinking lots of tea, flouncing about in your posh costumes. And the joyous thing about steampunk for me is that, yeah, it's quite often an alternate history, as, you know, as already been said by Andrew, it's there's just one sort of switching point where something happens that then sends you off down a different trouser leg of time. And what that switch is depends on the game that you're looking at, depends on the setting that you're looking at. But for me, I think the joyous thing about steampunk is that it can be so many different things to so many different people, and that it can encompass a whole. There is no one set thing that steampunk is, and you make it what you want of it, and you take from it what you want of it. But yeah, you've got to have that punk element. You've got to have that whole fighting something, social responsibility, social equality. As you said, it's because of the setting, it's usually Victorian and Edwardian. You cannot avoid the colonialism, the class structure, the sexism, the racism, all that sort of stuff. And for some people, that's the core of it. Other people don't feel able to tackle that, so they avoid it. Maybe it's just sometimes about telling stories in a world that we wish it could have been rather than the world that we know that it was.
Okay.
Yeah, well, you guys nailed it. I those were my two points. The idea that there is an overarching struggle that part of the background to the stories you're telling in punk, whatever the flavor of punk, and then this idea of an aesthetic where how things look and the particular appeal of big knobs and brass and corsets and carriages and all those sorts of things just sort of seems to resonate with some people. And I think even when it's not quite steampunk, there's still that idea of the sort of the technology and the costumes playing maybe a larger role in the aesthetic of the game than might be in a D&D game or a Call of Cthulhu game or something along those lines. But yeah, I think you guys nailed it.
Yeah, certainly a lot of the people we know through the live role playing side of it and the cosplay side of it, they're very creative people, and it is an outlet for them to explore their creativity and create these amazing, beautiful things.
So we've had a comment on the feed from Wolfenson. While I agree that steam-powered cyberpunk class issues might be the origins of the genre, it's long outgrown that and come to encompass gas lamp fantasy and neo-Victorian tales.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the point that I was making. Steampunk means so many different things to so many different people. You can make of it what you want. And as long as you're enjoying it, all power to you.
We've actually incorporated that element of gas lamp fantasy with 1879 with The Awakening. You have a Gilded Age Britain or Gilded Age world where technology has advanced, things have gone a bit differently, and then there's this major event that lets magic loose in the world again. And about 10% of the population awakens, and you have the Boojum races reappearing, the elves and dwarves and snarks and trolls, like you would have in Shadowrun. So we're playing through an Imperial Britain that it suddenly has four new species of intelligent life running around loose in it that a year ago were ordinary people. You've got the fantasy element of these traditional fantasy races suddenly reappearing, but you've also got the social issues of how do you deal with the fact that one of your best friends is now too large to fit into the pub.
You just put bigger doors on.
I've been in those pubs. You'd have to raise the ceiling. I've been in pubs where I had problems with the low ceiling.
As you guys saw in preparation for this panel, I cribbed a long list of games that someone thinks, anyway, are part of the steampunk genre. And just looking through them really quickly, I'd say that at least half of them, if not more, and there's 60 plus games on that list, incorporate some sort of element of the fantastical beyond just the steampunk technology, magic, or something similar to it. And I think the idea of the gaslight fantasy is kind of now almost, at least in gaming, a default of the steampunk genre.
I think we're all going to do that. We're all going to do that. Say the one when we mean the other. Yeah, I mean, that was when I was sort of preparing for this. I was thinking, well, I guess the steampunk game that I've played the most was probably Castle Falkenstein, and that's sort of fairly safe stuff. But I thought, well, I've played, you know, Iron Kingdoms, the Privateer Press RPG, War Machine and Hordes, and are things like that steampunk? Yeah, if it's essentially fantasy with a bit more. I mean, I guess you might put, you know, Warhammer roleplay in that category as well. Is that, you know, I guess those are maybe what steampunk in the wider sense, but maybe not when it comes to, you know, issues like class struggles.
Possibly.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say possibly. No, please go ahead, Andre.
No, I was referring to your earlier point that steampunk is many things to many people, and it's kind of what you define it as. Please, you know, it's your point. Take it away.
Yeah, well, like you said, I think you can have steampunk elements without being purely steampunk as well, which, again, is the joyous thing of it. It sneaks in everywhere when you're not looking. So, yeah, you know, Warhammer does have certain steampunk aesthetics because it's got the mechs, it's got that sort of crunchy tech feel to it that you would go for. It is interesting looking at the fact that a lot of the early steampunk games and a lot of the current ones as well do have that fantastical element, that magical element, which is something I deliberately didn't put into Cog's Cakes and Swordsticks. It's not there. There are no magical races. There is no magic. There is something weird going on for which there is a genuine reason, which may or may not ever get revealed, depending on whether I ever get a chance to write any more stuff for it. But It's almost like when it was first developing in games, because it came from the scientific romances very much, there was almost like a hedging of bets. It was like, well, people know D&D. They're comfortable with that. They're comfortable with fantasy races. Shall we just put this extra sort of brass and mahogany and cogs on to just like ease them in gently? I do often wonder about that.
That's a good point. I also think that the in steampunk, where there is no overt magic, I think that the technology itself often sort of replaces that, especially in role-playing games, because there's a reason why we don't use steam anymore. It's not as efficient as other technologies. A lot of the things that are built in steampunk movies or steampunk novels and role-playing games, just we don't have the engineering technology or the material science to make those kinds of things actually work like they do. And so it's a kind of magic in itself, because you replace the amazing things that you can achieve with these oversized, kludgy, but cool mechanisms. And I think it's almost just an alternative magic for that trope of role-playing games that needs to be fantastical.
There's probably a corollary to Clark's law involved here. Clark's law saying that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Sure.
Any sufficiently fancy technology is indistinguishable from magic in gaming terms.
If there's enough brass on it and dials and pressure releases, it's magic.
Yeah, I've got a scenario that for 1879 that revolves around a prototype locomotive that would probably never have been built. It's a steam turbine locomotive using supercritical steam, which is possible, but so incredibly unlikely with the materials science. The thing would be more like a bomb than a locomotive.
Well, basically, steam engines are mostly controlled bombs just waiting to go off.
What is that?
I mean, look at industrial accidents through the Victorian era.
Now, in 1879's case, the fantastic element was sort of de rigueur. We are the literal descendant of Earthdawn, which in turn is descended from Shadowrun. And so we have that whole cosmology of the cycles of magic and the recurrence of these fantastic races and so forth. I see 1879 as something of a sonnet. I'm free to say whatever I like within a very rigidly defined form. I think some other steampunk games have had a lot more latitude in developing their worlds. Richard, you were talking about the fantastic element and how diverse it can be. Have you looked at Victorious?
Oh, I haven't. No, I've not come across that one.
Victorious is basically steampunk superheroes. It's a very much of a superhero type of genre in a more or less steampunk Victorian world. What if...
It's like a Kerberos Club, the Fate supplement, similar.
Kind of. I haven't looked at it in depth. I'm not going to. I've made it a practice not to read other steampunk role-playing games because I don't want to accidentally mooch something that got into the back of my head. But the woman who is lead for Victorious is also one of the leads on an industry group I'm in on Facebook and over on MeWe. And so I see a lot of her posts about it. Looks really interesting.
Okay. Well, maybe check that out then. I mean, I'm always amazed at how many games there are out there and things that, I confessed that until I did some research on for today's panel. I hadn't heard of 1879. And I mean, that's, you know, I was a huge Shadowrun fan, and didn't, my friends kind of got into Earth Dawn when I sort of moved away, so I didn't really sort of get so much into that. But, you know, I was really surprised to find that there was this game out there that that I'd not heard of. And it's really, you know, one of the things I think is really useful about these kind of panels is sort of seeing all of the many things that are out there, that you know, the different games that sort of people might be interested in.
I mean, with the explosion of sort of self-publishing, drive-through places like that, where you can get, there's so much coming out, it's impossible for anybody to keep on top of everything. And so, yeah, you know, getting people together, getting people to do research to look into what's about, it's a great way to discover new stuff, because one game might not fit your group or your group's aesthetic, but something else out there certainly might.
Yeah, definitely an embarrassment of riches when it comes to role-playing in general, but certainly the genre.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got a question for you guys, if I can just pose one here. It goes back a little bit to what we were sort of talking about at the beginning, but why is it sort of the Victorian era specifically? Because I think some of the things that we talked about apply to other points in history, other places in the world. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on why is it seemed to at least centered on or originated in sort of, you know, Victorian England.
I suspect some of it has got to do with the scientific romances. That whole sort of Jules Verne, H.G. Wells era. And I think that's the touchstone for a lot of people when they start looking into steampunk and writing it.
So it just kept it tethered there by sake of history?
I suspect so, yes.
There's probably also a link to the Industrial Revolution, yeah, and the fact that steampunk is bound up intimately with the steam technology. And Britain specifically is a focal point of the Industrial Revolution. Have you ever been to a place called Ironbridge?
I have. I've actually done Victorian role-playing next to Ironbridge. We actually stayed in a youth hostel in Ironbridge and did our Victorian, slightly Cthuloid, long-running live-action campaign up there. It was awesome. Oh, that was when I was in full Victorian kit, shoveling coal onto a steam train's boiler. Into a furnace, rather, not the boiler. That would be very bad. So, yeah, no, I have, and it's a wonderful place, Coles Hill.
Oh, my eyes have turned such a bright green over there.
That was the hilarious one where all the boys got off to do plot at one of the earlier stations on the Severn Valley Railway, and all the girls stayed on to get to the end of the station, to the end of the line, and then we were hanging around waiting for them to get the train ready to turn round. So all the women in their full Victorian gear were chatting to the driver and his young mate, who really didn't quite know what to do with himself, surrounded by all these strange women. And yeah, we were on the footplate. We were helping fire the boiler up, ready for the return journey, which was really good. And then all the lads were incredibly jealous when they got back to discover we'd been playing with the engine.
Oh, I can imagine. Oh my gosh. So yeah, there is this entire, you know, cultural embedding that's involved here. The era that's usually referred to as the Victorian, we have to remember, is a very long time. Queen Victoria ruled for an incredibly long span.
She did indeed.
From the beginning of her reign to the end, there was so much that happened in the world, so many technological advances, so many cultural changes. You have this really incredibly rich vein of history to mine from. I think that's another part of what drives steampunk to that particular era and that particular place.
I think it's also the fact that the world's becoming more recognizable to us at that point. We're not that far removed from it in a lot of ways.
If you took someone from London in 1880 and you dropped them into New York City today, it would take them maybe a day or two to make some adjustments in their life. They would have to get used to the fact that the bus has only a driver and there is no cad taking the tickets. But they would recognize immediately, you take the bus to this area and then you walk the rest of the way to work and you pick up your breakfast from a cart on the sidewalk on the way. Things have changed and yet not changed in the past 140 years.
Well, you still got the London Underground. I mean, that was in its early stages during the Victorian era, and that's still going.
Well, as a role-playing genre, I think that's one of the sort of key things that make it playable for people, because that same similarity works in reverse, right? Mm-hmm. If someone says, I'm going to run a game in a fantasy world, you don't know what they're going to throw at you, so you can't make assumptions. But we've all seen movies or read books and know enough about the way the world works now that we can look back at that time. But it's different enough that we can still sort of make things up, and we can imagine that the world, even though there were many places that were known, there were still a lot of sort of shadowed corners of the planet that don't exist now that is fertile ground for running role-playing games, for creating the sense of wonder that's so often essential in plotting up a scenario.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
There's also been a lot of costume dramas and so forth that people have seen and who will have some vague idea. You know, people have gone to see the various remakes of Pride and Prejudice. They've watched a couple of seasons of The Paradise, or they've watched Penny Dreadful. And so they've got some vague idea from these costume dramas of this. I'm sort of trying to avoid the phrase comedy of manners, and it's not going to work. There's a certain way, a type of behavior that people have an idea of, whether it's accurate or not. So you don't have to learn as much of the world, as Jeff just pointed out. With a fantasy world, who knows what's lurking? But with a steampunk world, you can focus on the story a bit more because you have some expectations already about what the world itself is like.
Yeah, there's enough touchstones that you don't have to spend your time kind of spinning up the setting for your players.
It's interesting you mentioned Pride and Prejudice there, because of course that's where you start to get the bleed through, isn't it? Because that's the previous era, that's the Georgian era. But people still sort of extend it back, and you say you do come into the Edwardian era with Wells and various different people at that end as well. Obviously, we're talking a lot about the British end of things, sort of like centered on the British Empire and good old Queen Victoria, bless her. But obviously, you have other genres as well. So, I mean, one of the ones that I always had steampunky elements for me was Deadlands, which is American Wild West. There's a lot of the people we know for the cosplaying and the live role playing. Very much do the whole cowboy steampunk thing, which is fascinating as well.
Why wouldn't you do the cowboy steampunk thing? Come on.
Less cake, more whiskey and shooting.
Well, sure. Cowboys eat cake.
Mm-hmm. And we've had a few more comments from Wolfenson, sort of. I'd just turn to those briefly before we continue. He's been talking about running a fake game, and it was intended to be lighthearted, but the players steered it into urban fantasy gothic horror, much to his surprise or her surprise.
Oh, players are pesky that way.
Well, in steampunk, I mean, it's really just one step to the left to get into horror, right? I mean, I think Andrew, you mentioned Penny Dreadful. I mean, that's a good example, right?
Yeah. Well, science fiction and romantic, the scientific romances and things, they're all kind of developing from similar sort of areas. Okay, there's a lot of people reckon that Frankenstein is either the first Gothic horror or it's the first science fiction story. It depends on how you want to label it. And so, yes, again, that's something that we very much draw on because of when it is what we, or when we imagine it is, at least anyway, and how that all feeds into this sort of like dark, shadowy world of Sherlock Holmes, Jack the Ripper, foggy London streets, and goodness knows what else.
Yeah, no, that's all excellent points. I mean, it's just so rich for that sort of ethos that has been, like, probably through dint of history, and the types of stories that were inherited, at least in Western culture, from English writers, that just sort of then feeds back to that same aesthetic.
We've got a scenario in development right now called The Quiet Sisters that, for 1879, that is very definitely Gaslight horror. One of the things that we're looking at is how many different types of stories can you tell in this sort of a world? You know, we've done a steampunk Shadowrun world story. We've talked about colonialism and looked at it from the other side of it. We've done the high-tech thing with the locomotive story. The Quiet Sisters starts off with the players being asked to very discreetly investigate the disappearance of a body from the morgue. This family's daughter went to a fever hospital. She died, and then her body disappeared before they could give her a decent burial, and they would like to know what happened. And it goes terribly, terribly awry from there.
Well, of course it does.
It's not going to go happy from there.
And it's interesting as well, because obviously one of the things that Mike Mason is currently working on for Call of Cthulhu is getting Gaslight back up and doing a new version of that to come in with 7th edition. So obviously, because we also have Pulp Cthulhu, there are going to be elements of that brought into the new Gaslight. And of course, you can't really do that without doing a little bit of a nod to steampunk. So there may be some steampunky elements in there too. I don't know yet, because, you know, that's next year when we've cleared a whole load of other bits and bobs off. But yeah, it's, again, that horror element. People love horror games, so why not include steampunk elements if that's going to work for you?
Yeah, and then you can have the weird scientist with his gadgets facing off against the vampire hordes. Why not?
Yeah, I mean, I've run various COGS games at conventions and, on Halloween that have a distinct horror feel. I mean, it's mostly pulp. It usually ends up highly comedic just because of it's a D6 system, so things go horribly well or horribly, horribly wrong very rapidly. But yes, it's what we were saying before. It's many things to many people, and you can do so much with it, which is why it's such an interesting and rich field to play around in.
So is there anything that we think is absolutely essential in every, I mean, the panel is called Goggles and Gears. Are those two things absolutely essential, do we think, for steampunk? Or could you,
maybe not literally, but I would say that the central aesthetic has to involve sort of the power of technology. It doesn't have to be the focus of your story, but I think to really sort of be something other than just a game about revolution and fighting some overarching oppressive system, to be a cyberpunk or a Tesla punk or a steampunk version of that, you have to somehow nod to the technology as being a leveler, something that empowers the characters to take on that oppressive force. Otherwise, it's just a story about revolution, which is fine, but not one that I would necessarily think fits in this genre.
And there's a heck of a lot of revolution going on in that Victorian era. So, you know, but yes, I would have to agree with you that the technology is that keystone. It's in there. There's a fantastic cartoon by a Canadian artist called Kate Beaton. where there's a bunch of steampunkers go back, and I think it's Isambard Kingdom Brunel they end up bumping into. They go back in time, and they he's really confused by their desire to stick cogs on everything. And the comment is, but what does it do? So you kind of do have to be a little bit careful not to just look at steampunk. Or if I bung a cog on it, it'll be steampunk, because it's not quite. And some of the live role plays, one of my good friend Jem, her motto is, one should only wear goggles when one is inventing or driving. And again, it's sort of like, I think cogs and goggles have become easily recognisable symbols of steampunk, but that's not all it is or necessarily should be.
Yeah, one of the wizard hats and broadswords, right? I mean, yeah. It's just sort of the first trope you encounter.
to some extent, what the goggles and gears actually represent. One of the big differences in a steampunk game is that the player characters tend to win through by being frightfully clever. And the technology is a manifestation of their cleverness. Mm. They've been inventive enough and taken advantage of the resources of the environment in some sort of clever way. There's a sort of Doctor Who type thing here. Mm-hmm. Of going, oh, well, you know, I can... Or a MacGyver-ish type of thing of, I've got this assemblage of tools and spare parts, and I can bung something together that will allow us to win through. So there's a recognition of cleverness there. Now with and I know I keep referring to my own line here, but it's the one I'm the most familiar with. There's another world in 1879 called the Grosvenor World. It's on the other side of a stable wormhole from Greenwich Park. Yes, there's this huge stable wormhole sitting in the middle of the park. There's quite a bit of to do about it. So,
well, now I have to play this game.
This other world has three moons, and thus it has more eclipses, and thus you wear goggles when you're out in the wilderness because you need polarizing lenses for the frequent intercepts so that you don't suffer eye damage.
And in world justification for the cool tropes.
Exactly. This is the sort of thing we've been doing with Earthdawn. Or, you know, Earthdawn has all the stuff built in that explains why the tropes are there. And so we looked at the tropes for steampunk and said, all right, how do we justify everybody running around with a pair of goggles on their head all the time?
Nice.
Well, that does beg a question I have. It seems like when people mention steampunk, a lot of time there's kind of an eye roll, like, ugh, right? Because they're thinking, I mean, there's even a video, a song I saw, I think it's called Just Put Gears On It, right? You can see it on YouTube. And there's this idea that, I don't know, it's somehow sillier than a fantasy world or a sci-fi game or any other role-playing game, you know, intrinsically lower on the pecking order of genres in some people's minds. And I just never understood it. I don't understand why. And I was just curious if you guys had insight to that.
And again, I think it's because it's we say it's tropes. It's an easily recognisable trope. And as much as we would like to deny this, we are all terribly tribal about our games. And there is always that, well, my game's better than your game nonsense going on, instead of just recognising that different people like different things. And, you know, there is a big, wide playing field out there for us all to have fun on.
I agree with that 100%. I just feel like steampunk gets kind of pushed around by most of the other genres, and I just never quite understood why.
I don't know whether it's because there is a very large cosplaying element to it. Certainly sort of like in its visible real world format, it kind of has hit the mainstream, you know, like the normal people are aware of it. They see it. And again, they see cogs, they see people in corsets, they kind of recognize what it is.
It's kind of a hipster thing. I was into it before.
Possibly.
It was cool, and now it's cool, so I can't be into it.
Yeah, maybe.
Okay. I'll buy that.
They have beards, too. Maybe that's part of it.
Well, you know, I don't have what Andrew has, but you know, at least I'm not clean shaven.
I do have a question for you, actually, Jeff, because I adore Studio Ghibli films. Mm. They're wonderful. Sure. And Upwind, as you say, it is definitely a love letter to Ghibli and Castle in the Sky and various other, you know, Porco Rosso and things like that. And when I mentioned I was coming on this panel to my husband and I said that, you know, you were the designer of Upwind, he went, oh, I played that at OrcaCon in January. But was it you that was there running it, or had you got one of your little minions out there?
I must have had a minion. If I remember correctly, it was my friend Arthur who ran it. I have not had the luck of making OrcaCon yet. I'm going to go this year and run.
Oh, cool! Oh, excellent. We'll see you there. But he thoroughly enjoyed it. So your little minion did an excellent job because he got very excited when I mentioned it.
Good. Are you guys in the Seattle area?
No, I'm in the northeast of England, but I go over every year for OrcaCon because our friends organize it and run it, and excellent. It's wonderful.
Well, let's make a point of meeting up there.
Cool. So this is the other reason for doing these panels, Richard, is you get to make wonderful contacts and new friends. But no, I mean, so when you set out to do Upwind, was it specifically with the idea of having this love letter to Ghibli so that people could play in Laputa?
Sort of. I mean, it's not actually drawing much of the specific setting elements from their movies. But it takes sort of the central ideas of a fantastical world that isn't quite like our world, not following our laws of physics necessarily, not following our laws of evolution or even science and technology. There's a lot of, since it takes place on floating islands in a limitless sky, there's lots of vehicles that fly through the air, and you know, Studio Ghibli is obsessed with those sorts of things. And the presentation of the book is very intentionally animated. The characters, the drawings, the illustrations look more like Studio Ghibli stills than they do typical role-playing game illustrations, but we tried to really flavor it. A lot of Disney's Treasure Planet went into it, if you've ever seen that movie.
I think that's one I missed, actually.
Well, you should do yourself a favor and watch it. It's fantastic.
It's really quite brilliant. Yes.
Yeah. So there's a lot of that in it, a lot of Ralph Bakshi's wizards in it. But the sort of the main essence of the technology is this sort of like electrically powered leftover technology from a previous civilization, hence the Tesla punk.
Right? I was going to say that's where the Tesla punk's coming from, yeah.
Yeah, you got all this technology that there is also magic in the setting, a kind of elementalism, but the technology itself is sort of joined in with that. And it's the fantastical part of the setting that replaces the crazy steam engines.
And I have to say, I downloaded the preview that's on Drive-Thru, and it is beautiful. It is really, you know, it really does evoke that spirit.
I'm very pleased with how it's come out. Send me an email address after the panel, and I'll send you a PDF of it.
Thank you. Again, also another reason to do panels. Cool stuff.
We've had another comment, Wolfenson again, that they think that one of the reasons that, you know, steampunk is down the pecking order of game genres is because around 2010, everyone tried to apply steampunk aesthetic to their own fandoms, which I guess part of me is thinking, oh, it wasn't that long ago, was it? But, you know, you've seen sort of the Star Wars characters steampunked, steampunk versions and things like that. And there was basically an oversaturation and then a steep drop off following that. I don't know if that's sort of matches people's sort of experience.
Well, yeah, I guess it's the trouble of succeeding, right? When you become too popular. Yeah.
Yeah, again, coming at it from sort of like the cosplay live sort of element over here, at least in England. The first Asylum was, I think, in 2008, 2009. They've just had the 10th one this year, so it must have been 2009. We went to that. That's when Cogs and Cakes started to get developed, as I said, because there were lots of cosplayers who wanted to do the role playing. So I started to develop it and tested it out at subsequent runs of the Asylum. And it did sort of creep up, become very popular. It's now in Lincoln. It's on the August bank holiday weekend. And it's massive. I mean, it's not as massive as, say, Whitby Goth Week is, but you now have pretty much the whole of Lincoln, which is this relatively small medieval city in the East Midlands, taken over by steampunkers and the people who've come to look at the steampunkers and see them parading around in their posh costumes and things. So it has become very visible. It has become very popular. And this thing is, considering it started with, I think it was about 80 to 100 of us 10 years ago, and as now, you know, there's just thousands of people descend on this tiny, tiny place for that weekend to come see it, to experience it. And I do sometimes wonder if it gets looked down on a little bit, as you said, kind of like the hipsterish thing, oh, it was popular before, I was into it before it got popular thing, but also because it's sold out, it's gone mainstream, it's somehow recognisable and acceptable to the general population, it's not sort of like our special little secret thing anymore.
Humans are weird creatures.
Oh, heck yes.
There's also such a strong visual aesthetic to steampunk with the cosplay and the constructions and so forth, and the devices people build and so forth, that I think some people outside the genre tend to think of it as being rather shallow, that this visual aesthetic is all there is, that there is this veneer of, okay, well, you know, you've stuck cogs on it and added a pair of goggles and called it steampunk, and they don't see that there is a lot more to it. You know, there's this sort of expectation of having the depth of a rain puddle rather than a river, which you only really find if you get into it a bit more. You know, that it's very easy, as with some other aesthetics. Like, well, you mentioned the Whitby Goth. Goth has long had the same basic problem of people looking at it as just a fashion style and totally ignoring people who actually read the romantic poets and the music and everything else that goes with it.
Yeah, I think there is, again, it's an element of that. But for me, if the fashion is everything that is all that it is to you and you're enjoying it, wonderful. As long as you are enjoying it. And again, it's what we were saying about different people get different things for it. And one thing that always worries me in fandom is people going, oh, all they do is dress up. That's not important. Well, no, it's important to them. And as long as they're enjoying it and it's not hurting anybody, yeah, let them have their enjoyment. Let them have their fun. If you want to go deeper, here it is. As you say, there's more to it. You can immerse yourself more in it. But I would hate anybody to think that, you know, you can't just enjoy it on a sort of like a fashion level if that's your thing.
Right. But I mean, what's the rule of cool, right? The game masters are always suggested that we use when you're running games. If it's cool, do it, right? And we can't always define what's cool. And you look at people dressed up in cool steampunk regalia, and you know it's cool, and maybe you don't know why, but it's still enjoyable and fun. And yeah, it's a huge part of that aesthetic. No justification required beyond
exactly.
Just enjoying it.
Yeah, definitely. I didn't mean to suggest that there was a need to go any deeper than that.
Oh, no, I know you didn't. It's just, I know some people do, though, and it's something that it upsets me that people are that judgmental about it, because as long as people are enjoying themselves, you know, where's the harm, to be honest?
I think it is one of those human things, isn't it, that we always have the biggest issue with people whose interests or beliefs are the closest to ours, not the people who are interested in something completely different. It's always they like that, but, you know, they do it differently and they're wrong.
Yeah, right. Fantasy role players are not arguing with soccer fans over nuances. They're arguing with game nuances. Yeah, it's a good point.
Yeah, we should maybe try and make that a thing. Maybe we could all get you know, in the same camp. It's like, yeah.
Can we have RPG hooligans? That would be awesome.
Don't we already have RPG hooligans?
Well, they're not knocking down stands and running over. Well, I guess at Gen Con when they opened those doors to the dealers hall that first day, that's pretty hooliganish.
Oh yeah, that's a terrifying sight when that wave of people comes heaving towards you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Being in the vendor booth, on the other hand, all I see is lots of cash heading my way.
But there was once
playing industry. There's never a lot of cash. maybe for the cool Vinny the Knot booth, but
you know, I can dream. Okay, don't share my dream here.
All right, sorry. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to do that. I apologize.
But I'm having a fantasy. Give me a
we're very good at the fantasy part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've got a comment, Wolfenson saying, I would love to see images from that LARP, Lynn. Did a heavy role-playing LARP called Steam and Cinders. That's from Wolfenson again. And someone should write some fiction about steampunk football hooligans.
This is a really weird conversation we were actually having at Mini Kraken in Germany earlier this year, and it wasn't to do with steampunk, it was to do with Call of Cthulhu, and it was along the lines of, are there actually any Call of Cthulhu scenarios to do with sport? And we came to the conclusion that no, actually there weren't, and maybe we ought to do something about that. I think it's possibly easier in some ways to incorporate sport into some of the Victorian things, because they were very sporting. So obviously, you know, Cogs and Cakes does have cricket mentioned quite a lot. I think I mentioned rugby, none of that associated football nonsense. You know, that's definitely for the hoi polloi. Maybe we should have more sporting role playing scenarios. I don't know. And then we can go and talk to these football people, kicky ball and chucky ball people.
Imagine the Venn diagram of role players and sporting enthusiasts isn't necessarily a big overlap, at least seems to be in my experience.
You do know I got into role playing because of American football, right?
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, there's
so there is some overlap.
How did that work?
I turned up to the first night of my Freshers Week disco in my hall of residence wearing a Seattle Seahawks top. And some of the gamers who also lived at the hall of residence, who were second years, at least one of them was on the University American football team, because this was back when American football was big and new and shiny in the UK, decades ago. They sort of, because they were quite hard to get hold of, they came over to me and they said, oh, do you like American football? And yes, we got talking, and it turned out they were gamers, and they introduced me to the whole hobby. Well, so we do have some overlap.
And the Venn diagram is bigger in England than it is here, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, all Seattle teams are good in my book, but there you go. It is a strange one. I do remember decades ago Carl Sargent's Power Behind the Throne for Warhammer Roleplay, and there was a big festival on in the city, and there were some soccer football tournaments going on, but I think they hadn't quite worked out how the odds would work, or they hadn't thought that players would look at the odds for the games with any kind of level of detail, and my party ended up making a killing on the final by betting on both sides in a kind of a, you know, we can't possibly lose kind of way, right. So right. Yeah, I think that's the only sport in, unless it's, you know, giant robots sort of in the arena kind of sports, but that's a whole different.
There's a big resurgence of Blood Bowl going on right now, I know. And then there's Guild Ball and several, was Grid Ball, I think, from Warhammer, speaking of steampunk. But I know that there's a lot of sort of fantasy versions of miniature sports games. That's cool to see that.
We had a whole set of adventures in our Earthdawn campaign surrounding a dwarven sport called Hakvar, which is sort of a court ball game, not quite as murderous, but decidedly rough. And this Hakvar team that showed up at a party, and things got horribly out of hand in like seconds.
Well, maybe that's the reason there's not as much overlap, because it seems like in role-playing games, if there's a sport involved, it usually is to the death. So.
Oh, you mean Aussie rules football?
Yeah.
One of my players ended up accidentally inventing the sports bar. It was a thing. But yeah, this whole sports thing that got in, and the Hakvar tournament having an impact on the economy, and worrying about which team won because that determined where the riots were going to be in the city. And
beginning to think that most of us as gamers associate sports with rioting.
Where is that?
It's slightly sad, really.
Well,
yeah, it is a bit of a UK thing, really, isn't it? I mean, that's yeah, or has been.
Well, we've inherited some of it. Depends on, you know, night of the Super Bowl, the losing city is usually in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. So one other sort of question, we've talked I think probably more about the Steam than the punk sort of side of things. I don't know if this exactly fits in that category, but I've been wondering, with, you know, sort of, we've talked about you know, we're talking about a genre where there's off, you know, very kind of stratified, you know, society and differences between genders, and, you know, there's sort of racial issues, whether it's, you know, kind of historical racial issues, or if it's, you know, different, if it's, you know, the troll not fitting in the pub and the landlord doesn't really want the troll in the pub, so he's not going to make the door any bigger kind of, yeah, issues. I mean, yeah, we live in a, we mentioned Falkenstein as well, which is, I guess, is I think it's just actually coming out to retail this week again, but you know, is about 20 odd years old.
In 1994.
Have things, well, things have changed in our world in that time, whereby maybe 25, 30 years ago, people put a little bit less thought into how they fitted those kind of things into a game. When you're as writers, and how do you sort of how do you build that into your games and your settings, and how, when you're actually playing, you know, is that, obviously as a writer you need to do it in a way that caters for different people, but also how do you, you know, when you're actually running games, how do you deal with those kind of issues?
Well, since nobody else is jumping in. Okay, first off, we have a social level stat in 1879, where your character is on a 1 to 5 scale, with 1 being the criminal underground and 5 being an aristocrat. Your relative social level impacts your die rolls for interactions. If you're a social level 1, you're going to be at a disadvantage for trying to deal with anybody except people on your social level. Whereas if you're at a social level of 5, you're going to be able to lord it over pretty much anybody, rather literally. There is a recognition and renown thing going on of how well you're recognized. One of the big things, though, is dealing with the issue of racism, and in dealing with the issue of, with civil rights and so forth, we spent a good deal of effort explaining why women got the vote in earlier in our game world than they did in the historical world. And it happens for several different reasons in different places. In Britain, it happens because of a couple of historical events, technological advances, and the fact that Dr. Elizabeth Garrett Anderson is the one who saved Prince Albert when he had his coach crash. And Queen Victoria said, "We need more of those," and endowed a school of medicine for women. We also based it off the Pharmacy Act, which is a real world thing. The Pharmacy Act was an attempt to get the high street chemists under some sort of control, as pretty much anybody who had the money could put up a shingle and call themselves a chemist. And so the Pharmacy Act went in, and when they wrote it, they didn't look quite as closely at the language as they might have. And when they held the first examination, a lot of women showed up, and they looked at the regulation, and it said, any person who passes the examination. They had forgotten that this incredibly chauvinistic patriarchal parliament had said person instead of man. And now they were stuck with it. And a lot of women passed the exam and became high street chemists. Becoming an apothecary became a respectable profession for a woman. Once you are a professional and you have property and you are running a shop and so forth, you qualify for the vote. And they sort of just gave up on the whole idea of trying to fight against women's suffrage at that point.
Nice way of doing it.
Yeah, we leveraged a lot of, you were talking about switches that send you down the other trouser leg. And we'd looked at a lot of those in constructing the game world. With North America, the American Civil War grinds to a halt a year later than it ended in our world, with the Confederacy still in existence. The loss of life on both sides is so massive that you have women running the factories because there aren't enough men left in the Union to do it. And when the war ends, these women running the factories basically said to their representatives, you have a decision to make. Either you give us the vote, or we walk off the job and go back to being happy little homemakers like you'd like us to be, and you're good luck finding enough people to run the factories and keep the economy from collapsing. And the government basically was over a barrel about this and said, all right, you've got the vote. So we've dealt with a lot of that, but we're also dealing with some things head on. It is still a very racist culture. We're not trying to erase that. And we're going to be confronting it more directly in some areas than others. When we do the book, the source book for the Confederacy, we are bringing in a black writer from the American South to write that book and to write it from the standpoint of the black population and describe what the Confederacy is like for them. Because we know what the Confederacy was like for white people. We need to hear the other side of the story. We're doing the same with the Raj. We're bringing in a writer from India to write the Raj source book and to tell it from the Indian side of the story. With Shadowrun, the meta races suffer a good deal of discrimination, but it's endemic in the culture, and the whole awakening was a generation ago. You look at one of the key events of the Shadowrun world, the Night of Rage, which was basically Kristallnacht. By the time the game world begins in 2050, the Night of Rage was a generation ago. If you compare it to Kristallnacht, World War II had been over for like 6 years, and a lot of the settled things had settled out. With 1879, we're actually playing through that. The awakening was only a year ago when the game world begins. People are still coming to terms with the fact that there are new species they're just beginning to realize that these are not deformities induced by a disease. These are speciation. The trolls are having troll children. And so we're playing through that and using that to look at the problems, the social issues of that period in history, not just in the British Empire, but in North America, in Russia, in the Prussian, and throughout Europe, in Asia, you know, both Central Asia and far and Eastern Asia. We'll be doing a Japan source book that's going to get into that. So yeah, we're working through it, and I've gone on for rather a long time. So let me pass off to someone else for a while.
Yeah, I mean, it's great to hear what you're saying. I'm just thinking we've got about 12 minutes left. So, so Jeff, do you want to go next?
Yeah, I was just going to kind of follow up on a more generalized comment with regards to sort of the social, racial, political issues that are endemic in the more generalized steampunk genre. And I think it's like any role-playing game. I mean, you can ignore these things to your peril, or you can address them honestly and head-on and make them part of the story, because all good stories deal with those sort of real elements in being a human. And as long as it's done respectfully and with a clear, respectful intention, I think it can be a pretty powerful part of the setting of the game itself. I guess the danger comes when you're flippant or you don't think about the consequences of the decision you're making as a writer, and you're putting it into sort of the canon of the universe, or even just as a game master with your local group, not making it clear where you stand and why, and that you have healthy sort of perspective and opinion on these conflicts and differences. I think they're valuable parts of the story that shouldn't be overlooked, but they're ones that you need to come at with at least a recognition and a sensitivity and some basic level of respect.
Yeah. I mean, with Cogs, I came at it from more of a pulp side of things. And in many ways, it's what I wish the British Empire had been rather than what it actually was, which was just sickening and disgusting on so many levels. And when I'm writing stuff for Call of Cthulhu, I really have to be very careful to keep that sort of like wish, you know, the sort of edge out of my voice, because I so wish I could go back and slap a lot of them senseless for just being hideous,
there's
vile
people.
People
right now that you're slapping. So if you're ready to slap, you need your help over here.
So with Cogs, it's you know, in the introduction, it's like the Victorian world was one of hideous inequalities. And, you know, you cannot deny that. You cannot defend that. It's there. How much of that you want to incorporate into your Cogs game is entirely up to you and your group. But like I said, I tend to run it from an idealized point of what I wish it really had been. So you still have this social stratification in terms of the rich, middle class, poor. But there is very little in the way of sexism. There is very little in the way of racism, the way I run it and play it, because I think that gives everybody a much richer experience, bringing in all sorts of different sexes, races, you know, just so that it's a more interesting and entertaining story. Because I get really bored by things that are purely just white people running around doing stuff. I want to incorporate elements from other cultures, respectfully, because that gives you so much richer world, a far more interesting world to explore and play with. So, yeah, it's what you were saying. You have to acknowledge it. You can't pretend it wasn't there. And if you want to go into the social side of it and really hit it head on like you're doing with 1879, that's good, because we can't pretend it didn't happen and we shouldn't ignore it and we do need to discuss it. But I also think that that's not, again, not necessarily for everybody. And sometimes you do just want a piece of escapist fluff if you'll pardon the expression, where you can put that on the back burner because that might be something you have to deal with every day in your real life and you don't necessarily want it in your game world too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we've got sort of comments to that effect, I guess, in chat as well. It sort of depends on what the group wants to experience, you know, whether you sort of focus on those kind of things or, you know, because, you know, steampunk is also, there are fantasy games out there. We don't have to address those things and we can just focus on the good things like the cake and the tea and the costumes, things like that. But yeah, okay, that's really great answers. Got about 7 minutes left. Is there any, it feels like we've sort of only just got started really in many ways. Is there anything any of you would sort of like to talk about or discuss or add?
Oh, Jeff, was there anything on your really wonderful list that you did for us that we haven't covered?
I'm looking at that right now. I think we've kind of touched on most of what I came up with. I'd be curious. I'm wondering what other non-Western things we would classify as ex-punk role-playing games. Because I think as cool as the Victorian aesthetic can be, there's got to be some equivalent sort of cultural touchstones that would make for fantastic role-playing settings.
Well, I mean, Andrew's touched on India. I mean, that is a fascinating culture. Okay, the Raj mucked it up quite a bit, but, you know. I'd love to see an African one, to be quite honest, because there is so much amazing stuff in terms of history and things that, you know, as the Western world, we've ignored for far too long.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to see something set in Africa that doesn't just involve dinosaurs. As much as I love dinosaurs hidden in the Congo, I really would like to see an Afrocentric steampunk kind of, or Afrocentric punk game. That would be wonderful.
Well, so I noticed someone in the group added a comment about jade punk, which was a term I'd never heard before. I believe that was one of you wrote that in the Facebook chat we were having.
Yeah.
Jade familiar punk, with that?
Jade punk is a game system, but it's also essentially Far Eastern Malu. Of looking at, well, what if you had this sort of advanced, what sort of technological advances could you have in, say, the Edo period of Japan or in Imperial China? You know, if you look at the stuff that's in the Red Dragon Manual, which is a classic of Chinese literature, they developed an awful lot of ideas that they never really did anything with. They had an aerodynamic missile. Basically, this airfoil-stabilized ground-to-ground missile that they developed that they kind of mucked about with a little and got it working and then said, okay, well, you know, we're done with that. What if they kept on, you know, if they'd incorporated that into their warfare?
Mm.
There's so much you could do with that, just with the technological advances that China actually made and then never really incorporated into their... They never use them, yeah.
Yeah, it's also interesting whether people would set games in them where they're sort of, you know, when they close themselves off to the outside world as well, so that there is no Western influence. So you can sort of get rid of all of that.
Mm.
Or do it, as you said, like almost as the equivalent of the Awakening in 1879, whereas it's just as the world is opening up to these weird people from outside that are messing things up.
Yeah, and I think that's where the interesting difference would be. It seems like many steampunk games
have supplements that reach out to other parts of the world, but they still are heavily influenced by sort of that Western expectation and whatever the premise is for the particular game. And it would be really interesting to see something completely divorced from that coming, originating from that source material.
Okay, getting some comments. There's a website specifically about non-Western steampunk called Beyond Victoriana. So
ooh, that excellent.
Might be worth checking out. So that there is an Afro setting, post-apocalyptic, which, you know, actually in about sort of 10 to 15 minutes, we're doing a similar panel about post-apocalyptic. So, yeah, that's an appropriate, maybe an appropriate one for that.
Excellent. I should go and have a look for that.
A European RPG called Degenesis. So that might be
thank you very much for that suggestion, Wolfinson.
That's cool. Hey, can I do a semi-AetherCon plug as we close up here? Mm-hmm. I've got a couple spots in my Upwind game, which is being run in about 40 minutes. If anyone listening or anybody on the panel has some free time and wants to play, I know that there's a few people in it already, but there's a couple seats left if anyone's interested. You can just look on the events pages and look up Upwind.
Okay.
There's a panel for FASA in about 40 minutes also. I'll be on that along with Josh Harrison, who is line developer for Earthdawn, and with also Leanne, who is the developer for Demon World. So we got that coming up.
I'm going to be terribly lazy. I'm going to go and have my tea and put my feet up and watch stupid television for the evening.
Okay, sounds good. Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess if there's nothing else, I'd like to thank the panelists, Lynn Hardy, Jeff Barber, and Andrew Ragland for participating. And good luck with your games and panels that you have coming up, and tea, although I assume that will not require a skill roll.
I hope not.
And thanks very much. And for those of you watching, we'll be back in about 10 minutes with a panel on post-apocalyptic games. Entitled Four on the Floor and Six in the Chamber. So you might want to go and take a quick break and then come back for that, or check out one of the other things going on.
Okay. And can I, on behalf of my fellow panelists, thank you, Richard, for having us on this evening and taking good care of us.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Thanks for being involved in us.
Okay. Right. So we'll leave the hangout room going. And if the three of you want to exit out when you're ready, and then we'll kind of shut it down for 10 minutes.
Okie dokie. Well, thank you very much for having us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you all three.
Evening, everyone.
Evening.
Take Cheers. Care.
Bye.
See you at OrcaCon.
See you at OrcaCon.